Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Like so many of his predecessors, Florida's new incoming governor insists his administration will make education a high priority, and that includes more money for teachers.
In Florida, we just have to figure out how to make sure the masses of educators feel that they start every day out with fair and appropriate compensation.
Also this week, it would seem the state's new education commissioner is also determined to make his mark quickly on Florida's public schools.
This work impacts every district in the state and every student at every age level.
We'll also visit a few legislative delegation meetings around the state where ordinary people were telling their lawmakers what they'd like to see made priorities during the upcoming legislative session, and we'll find out that a national championship doesn't necessarily involve men's football in college. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida Governor-elect Ron DeSantis is crafting his policy agenda and has turned to a group of thinkers from across the state to help. One of those groups, the Education and Workforce Transition Committee, is working on its proposals for DeSantis. Len Hatter listened in on one of the group's recent meetings.
DeSantis has floated the idea of setting a threshold for classroom spending, similar to a medical loss ratio in healthcare. DeSantis proposes 80% of education dollars going directly into the classroom. It may sound like a good idea, but what exactly does that classroom spending include? Transition team member and physician Andy Jacobs says before any cap is put in place, there should be at least some way of creating a uniform financial reporting system for public schools.
I think to a great extent, the reporting systems are opaque. The definitions from district to district are not adhered to. I think before we start to answer the question of how much money should be given for direct instruction, we need to have a uniform reporting system and some very clear, simple definitions.
Furthermore, not all school districts are created equal. That target may be easier for larger districts to hit because they have more money and more resources. But smaller and rural districts could struggle. State Education Board Vice Chairman Andy Tuck says 80% may be a hard goal for those schools to reach, and he wants to see a conversation about sharing services among cash-strapped school districts.
We've got to have bus drivers. We've got to have food service with people. We've got to have all these other things. I'm not saying that we're totally top heavy, but there are some things that we might look at maybe privatizing to save some money or like I said, working with other counties on an overall picture.
Then there's the issue of teacher pay. In Leon County, teacher salaries and benefits already make up about 80% of the district's budget. Classroom spending is much more than just teacher pay, and Florida ranks in the lower third of states when it comes to how much it pays teachers. Both Texas and Georgia pay about $5,000 more and rank far higher, even though they're similarly sized.
In Florida, we just have to figure out how to make sure the masses of educators feel that they start every day out with fair and appropriate compensation before we consider like what additional compensation bonus structures look like for performance.
That's Desmond Blackburn, the former superintendent of Brevard Schools. The state has increasingly tied teacher pay to student performance, largely based on standardized tests. The Education Transition Committee is considering more ways to do that, mostly through the way the state awards bonuses. But Blackburn argues teachers do more than just teach, and not everything can be quantified.
You know, we're starting to realize, thankfully, that the teacher's responsibility has more to do with the entire child and not only that singular metric. So like, how do we add in the fullness of our expectation of the teacher to what we eventually compensate them for?
The group is also looking at ways of using compensation to encourage teachers to mentor each other and get some non-traditional teachers into the classroom. Those could be professionals in other industries who now want to teach what they've learned. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis has already staked out his position when it comes to school choice. The selection of former House Speaker Richard Corcoran signals DeSantis plans on continuing increasing the state's school choice offerings. The question traditional school advocates are asking is whether they'll have a seat at the table. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Republican former Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran will make his mark on the state's public schools as the new Commissioner of Education. Ryan Daly tells us Corcoran was voted into the post unanimously by the state's Board of Education this week, eliciting strong and wide-ranging reactions from stakeholders.
This work impacts every district in the state and every student at every age level in our education system.
That's State Board member Marva Johnson explaining how crucial the commissioner's role is.
The commissioner has the pleasure and the responsibility of directing the great work of staff members in 7 statutorily named divisions, as well as in the Office of K through 20 Articulation, Office of Independent Education and Parental Choice, which includes the Office of Early Learning and K through 12 Choice, and the recently created Office of Safe Schools.
Shortly after being voted into the post unanimously, Corcoran told reporters his priorities starting day one are that of the man who appointed him, Governor-elect Ron DeSantis.
He's talked about increasing opportunities in vocational industry certification and technical education. He's talked about increasing choice options. He's talked about improving our curriculum. He's talked about reevaluating our standards. He's talked about making sure that we try to get 80% of all dollars into the classroom so that the children benefit.
The state board questioned Corcoran on what could be the hallmark of his educational profile, his connection to charter schools. A longtime vocal proponent of school choice, Corcoran's wife is also the founder of a charter school and is on the board of another. State board member Tom Grady asked about potential conflicts of interest.
Have you ever been paid by anyone within the charter school industry for any services rendered to the charter school industry, broadly defined?
Not a single penny, indirectly, directly, any way you could possibly imagine. Never a law client, nothing, zero.
Corcoran insists he will use his new post to boost traditional public and charter schools alike.
I'm a product of the public school system, the traditional public school system, and an advocate for the traditional public school system. I'm an advocate for choice.
And he got an endorsement from Tallahassee Community College President Jim Murdaugh.
Speaker Corcoran has for years demonstrated his commitment to increasing high-quality pathways for students.
And although Mr. Corcoran is an experienced attorney and politician, he has no major experience in education or education policy. To date, he has not subscribed to the uniform system of public education required by the Constitution.
The board heard from detractors as well. Catherine Baer spoke at the meeting representing Common Ground, which she describes as a nonpartisan, unpaid education advocacy group. She identified herself as a homeschooling parent and made a last ask for a national search before approving Corcoran. Baer says she'd like to see a commissioner who will remove Common Core standards, something that was a point of emphasis for DeSantis during his campaign.
Richard Corcoran has been one of those people who has squarely put it in his sights to advance the position of charter schools and vouchers and things that promote something other than what we know as public education.
That's Frederick Ingram, president of statewide teachers union, the Florida Education Association. He has been a vocal critic of Corcoran's ideas, but says collaboration is a must for the good of students.
Because we're ready and willing, and we're extending a hand of friendship on behalf of 200,000 teachers and 2.8 million children. We need him to be a collaborator. We need him to be an entrusted person who's going to bring all stakeholders to the table. And if you don't bring all stakeholders to the table, then our children are in the balance.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, education is certainly critical, but Florida has other priorities as well. This week, lawmakers were meeting with the folks in their home districts to get a better idea as to what those priorities might be.
I know it's hard, but we need to increase mental health funding, or we will see more tragedies, more deaths, more children, and more of our neighbors dying unnecessarily.
But no matter how important something might be, there's no guarantee it will be addressed if lawmakers don't have the money to deal with it. This week, the state of Florida got some good news in that regard.
Our job as principals is to take account of where we think we are in the economic cycle and bring that to this.
And when you say the words national championship, the common assumption is you're talking about college football. as played by men. But that doesn't mean a collegiate women's athletic program can't achieve equal greatness, even if that program isn't funded anywhere near the same degree as men's sports.
All things look positive, but we just can't rest on what we've had in the past. You know, we have to keep moving forward just as they do in men's sports.
Florida lawmakers are hearing from the public on such things as election reform, public school funding, and mental health. Blaise Ganey reports from Broward to Bay County. Legislators are getting an earful from the public on exactly where the focus should be during the 2019 lawmaking session.
State lawmakers will likely be tackling election reform following recounts in three tight races. Bay County Supervisor of Elections Mark Anderson spoke about changes he thought could help elections go smoother in the future.
We've come to the conclusion that for Election Day, instead of setting up 44 separate different locations that voters have to go to the right location, I'd have 10 mega sites and I'd have them open through that voting period. Believe it or not, the last election, the last general election day, was the smoothest, easiest election day that I've ever had in the 18 years I've been in my office. And it's simply because it was just easier to manage.
Anderson says he doesn't encourage vote by mail to citizens if they can avoid it because he knows the chances are higher of that ballot not making it back in time. That was one of the many issues that led to post-election lawsuits. Meanwhile, Panama City manager Mark McQueen is asking for around $70 million for debris removal. Hurricane Michael created more than 2 million cubic yards of debris in Panama City alone. Leon County Supervisor of Election Mark Early is focused on the validation process for felons registering to vote under Amendment 4. It restores voting rights for felons not convicted of murder or a sexual offense.
It's just a more complicated validation process. You have to find the person, determine what kind of felony it was, and then somehow find out whether they've fulfilled all the requirements set forth by the court. And that investigative process can be much more difficult than just checking to see if the state clemency board gave them the rights back.
As for the actual process the felons will have to follow to register to vote, Democratic Senator Bill Monfort believes the legislature needs to make no more changes to allow them to register on January 8th. In Hillsborough County, there's an ask for mental health funding after several first responders committed suicide within the past few months. Here's Lisa Monteleone, a board member for a local health center.
I'm begging you, when you go to Tallahassee, to look at the taxpayer funds. I know it's hard, but we need to increase mental health funding or we will see more tragedies, more deaths, more children, and more of our neighbors dying unnecessarily.
Meanwhile, in Broward, Public School Superintendent Robert Runcie came with a list of requests.
So those are big asks, right? So funding, continue to ensure that the resources for 7026, which is safety and security, the mental health resources and others, that those continue to be funded, maintain the rates for our required local effort, redirect the best and brightest funds into a pool of dollars that we can properly compensate teachers, and support for a victims compensation fund.
That compensation fund would be for the victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. Counties will continue to have delegation meetings as we near the start of the 2019 legislative session. Lawmakers will return to Tallahassee in March. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaise Ganey.
Last week, a Senate committee heard that, because of Hurricane Michael, a potential surplus of more than $220 million had likely disappeared from next year's state budget. This week, though, the outlook turned more positive. Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan reports analysts are projecting a significant increase in state revenue over 2 years.
Budget analysts periodically meet inside a building next to the Capitol for what's known as the Revenue Estimating Conference.
With the exception of sales tax and corporate income tax, the changes to the individual revenue sources were minor, with positives and negatives across the sources largely offsetting each other.
These conferences aren't exactly enthralling, but they are necessary. Analysts from various government agencies try to come to a consensus on how much money Florida lawmakers will have to work with in the coming years based on the state and national economy.
Our job as principals is to take account of where we think we are in the economic cycle and bring that to this.
That's Amy Baker, coordinator for the legislature's Office of Economic and Demographic Research. She and other policy wonks have to make sense of a state budget that's currently worth nearly $89 billion. They issue outlooks on everything from Medicaid funding to public school enrollment. For hours, they go over documents and talk numbers, mostly in the millions.
Sales tax collections supporting the general revenue fund have exceeded the monthly estimates by $173.5 million since the last conference.
During the recession, Baker and other analysts tracked a reduction in income from tourist taxes and other means of revenue. The result was a decrease in the state budget and a cut in some programs. The state is in much better shape today. General revenue projections are up by $842 million over 2 years. The Revenue Estimating Conference credits a recent surge in sales tax and corporate income tax collections for the boost.
While this is the largest combined increase since April 2006, during the peak of the housing boom, the conference recognizes that there is an elevated level of risk due to the mature stage of the current economic expansion.
If the revenue projections hold, incoming Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida legislature will be under less pressure as they draft a state budget for consideration during the session that begins in March. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Earlier today, the state of Florida said goodbye to a former leading lawmaker who would go on to become a ferocious advocate for higher education. T.K. Wetherill died last Sunday after going into hospice care. His funeral took place at Florida State University's Ruby Diamond Concert Hall, and that's because Wetherill was FSU president from 2003 through 2009. Among those delivering eulogies, the school's current president and also a former state House speaker, John Thrasher. Here are a few of his remarks.
Today, we're gathered to say goodbye to a great friend and a great Floridian. To Ginger and the entire Wetherill family, Kent, Gene and I, and the FSU community, mourn with you and offer you our deepest condolences. You know, he may have been known to everybody as TK, but Thomas Kent Wetherill was far, far from a simple man. He was an athlete and an academic, a politician and president. I looked at him as just a good old boy who just happened to have a PhD. I've been envious of that. There really was, and there really won't be, anybody like TK. He was an original, authentic, and true. A creative problem solver, a clever, more than clever, legislator. A crafty deal maker, and may I add, at times, a rather colorful person with our language. Somebody said I should say linguist, but I'm not sure TK or I would know what that means. I mean, you know, who doesn't in this room, and I see so many friends, who doesn't have a story about TK's legendary way with words? Like the time during a news conference with cameras rolling, he got a little too comfortable. Some of us have done that before. He got a little too comfortable and referred to a very fine small southern college as a dipstick school, quote unquote. Actually, he didn't stay stick. That prompted the president the next day to send a letter to TK, and as you can imagine, he wasn't too pleased. But my point is, that was TK. He said what was on his mind. He did what he thought was right. And he never failed to see the humor in all of it.
That was present Florida State University President John Thrasher speaking today at the funeral of his predecessor, TK Wetherill. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, it's no secret that a national title is the ultimate achievement for any collegiate athletic program. Earlier this month, the Florida State University women's soccer team earned a national championship after beating the University of North Carolina. Eleanor Clark reports despite a banner year for women's sports, FSU's athletic funding has gone disproportionately to the men's programs.
On a brisk, early December evening, a banquet hall at Florida State University's Doak Campbell Stadium is packed with people. They're here to celebrate the women's soccer team, who just won a national championship. Occasionally, cheers echo around the bright room. Young fans line up alongside older fans, decked out in Seminole gear, all waiting to ask the players to sign their posters. Later, University President John Thrasher recognized the accomplishment.
These women showed the country the heart, the grit, the determination that represents what Florida State is all about.
2018 has been a particularly important year for women's athletics at FSU. Women's softball at the school won its own national championship, and women's beach volleyball ended its season as the national runner-up. 2018 also marks the 50th anniversary of women's athletics at the school. But across FSU, there's financial inequity between men's and women's sports.
And Florida had a little trouble passing it too tight. Back row setter, Florida is playing a 6-2 in their back row setter.
Cecile Renaud has been around women's athletics at FSU for the last 42 years. She's a former professor and women's volleyball coach who calls the volleyball games.
To see how far it's come and how much we've grown, it makes me feel a lot older. But certainly Title IX, when that came along in the early 70s, helped.
Title IX is the federal statute that makes it illegal for universities receiving federal funds to discriminate on the basis of sex. Renaud says money for athletics is divided unevenly between men's and women's teams at the school. That's not illegal under Title IX. The statute only requires scholarship awards to go to men and women athletes proportionately. So because 43% of athletes at FSU identify as women, 43% of scholarship money FSU awards to athletes must go to women. And it does.
Florida State was one of the first programs that really fully funded scholarships for women in the 80s.
Title IX requires treatment and benefits to be equitable, but that doesn't always mean equal money. Every year, the U.S. Department of Education publishes data online about how much schools across the nation spend on athletics. According to the report, for the 2016-2017 year, FSU had pretty much the same number of male and female athletes. But FSU spent almost $2 million less on recruiting for women's teams. And a similar trend shows up when looking at coaches' pay. During the December celebration for the women's soccer team, Coach Mark Krikorian started toward the podium when a fan shouted something. The fan called out, "Give him a raise," earning laughs from the crowd. But the fans' comments were right on the mark. Data shows at Florida State for 2016-2017, people paid to coach men's sports made on average about $1.4 million, while the people FSU paid to coach the women's teams made less than a third of that. Some people claim women's teams should get less money from schools, because men's teams are traditionally better moneymakers. But at FSU, most women's teams aren't able to make significant revenue because the school doesn't charge to get into most games. Meanwhile, FSU men's and women's teams have a similar national championship record. The men's teams have 10 and the women's teams have 9. 4 of those wins came in the last 5 years, and 3/4 were from women's sports.
I mean, I think we've come so far, but we've got to, you know, I just don't want people to think that we're there. There's a lot of work still to be done for us to be the best athletic department in the country for women and women's sports.
Renaud says if FSU wants the women's teams to continue winning championships, the school needs to make sure teams have the funds they need to be successful. She says updating facilities, increasing coaches' salaries, and more exposure are a good start.
So, you know, all things look positive, but we just can't rest on what we've had in the past. You know, we have to keep moving forward just as they do in men's sports.
But part of the problem is that FSU officials decide where money goes once it's donated. And often, that money goes disproportionately to men's sports. Earlier this year, Florida State announced a fundraising campaign to raise $100 million for the athletic department over the next 5 years. It's called the Unconquered Campaign. FSU has already announced $60 million will go toward a state-of-the-art new football facility, and $5 million will go toward women's athletics. Renaud has two ideas to help. The first is hiring people to specifically work on fundraising for women's sports. Another solution is asking people who donate money to the athletics program to make clear they want their donation to go towards women's athletics.
Each one of the sports now have their own coaches club, so money can be donated there and the coach can help direct it where it needs to go.
In 2000, Lucy McDaniel donated $1 million to FSU, and she requested the money be used for a scoreboard for the women's volleyball team. She was an FSU graduate and former student athlete who hoped her donation would inspire other women to donate money specifically to be used for women's sports. Earlier this year, the FSU women's softball team won a national championship, the third in school history, but the first in the fast pitch era of the sport.
And on the 10th try, the Florida State Seminoles have won their first national championship.
Renaud says the softball team wants a new scoreboard, but the school hasn't found the funds yet. Next door to the softball complex is the university's baseball stadium. A new $1 million scoreboard looks down onto the baseball diamond. The FSU men's baseball team has never won a national championship, but the women's soccer team has.
Yeah, everybody stand up, all the team. Like, these are my sisters, basically, and now we have this moment forever. Start with Brooke.
Now, back at the celebration, the team has climbed on stage for pictures. Laughing, they're putting their arms around each other. The FSU marching chiefs play a few recognizable chords, and the women start to sing. I'm Eleanor Clark.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank Eleanor Clark and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. Happy holidays, and please join us next week at this time for our special year-end report from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.